Today's episode is going to be slightly different from most episodes of Why I'll Never Make It. That's because it was born out of a collaboration between myself and another podcast called The Industry, hosted by Dan Delgado. Now, in some ways, it's like the movie version of this podcast, focusing on the challenges and failures that go into film production and takes a closer look at some of the lesser-known and sometimes forgotten stories of Hollywood. I really love this podcast and have been listening to it for about a couple of years now. And, well, back in the summer of 2021, I was listening to him talk about this obscure movie called The Bluebird, which was a curious collaboration between the U.S. and the Soviet Union back in the 1970s. And one of the child actors in that movie was Stephen Warner. Now, that name may not be familiar to you, but I immediately recognized it, because he starred in one of my favorite movie musicals of all time, The Little Prince, which was from 1974 and written by none other than the Broadway composing team Lerner and Lowe. It starred such legendary performers as Bob Fosse, Richard Kiley, Gene Wilder, and Donna McKechnie. Well, the wheels in my brain started turning, and I eventually reached out to Dan Delgado.
Doing this episode was your idea. I was minding my own business. Patrick kind of barged in. I've got an idea.
Right.
I said, okay. So my question to you is, why did you want to tell this story? This story of the adaptation of The Little Prince?
Well, for the longest time, since I was a young boy, when I first saw the movie adaptation, I loved the music. I loved the story. I thought it was this kind of like fun, great movie. Come to find out, it was a commercial flop. No one really likes it. People think it's weird or bizarre. I even took it to film class when I was in college, and the teacher didn't think much of it.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Right? So for me, I've always felt like cheerleading the underdog when it comes to this movie. Why didn't this movie do well? It has such a great cast. It has great songs by a Broadway composing team. So I thought your podcast would be the perfect place to highlight what went right and what went wrong with this movie adaptation. I am so grateful that Dan ran with this idea and what ultimately became a two-part miniseries covering not only that Lerner and Lowe movie musical, but also the recent Netflix movie adaptation and a couple of Broadway productions as well. So today you'll get to hear a portion from part one focusing on that 1974 film as I introduce you to Stephen Warner and what went wrong with one of my favorite movie musicals of all time.
I remember thinking that I was in some ways a little bit disappointed because they'd cut out lots of bits that I really liked. And I was like, what happened to that bit with Gene? And what happened to that bit? You know, why is that not in there?
Welcome to a special episode of Why I'll Never Make It, a Top 25 Theater Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, with a little help from The Industry's Dan Delgado, sharing stories of personal struggles and professional hardships with lessons that we can all learn from. To find out more about Dan, check out industrypodcast.org. And for me, as always, you can go to whyillnevermakeit.com or look for the link in the show notes. The Little Prince was first published in 1943 and written by French writer and aviator Antoine de Saint-Exupéry while he was living in New York City. It has gone on to sell more than 140 million copies worldwide and translated into more than 300 languages and dialects, making it one of the best-selling and most translated books ever published. So with such a popular book, generation after generation, who wouldn't want to adapt the story onto the stage or screen? But Christine Nelson, a curator with the Morgan Library and Museum here in New York, which is where Saint-Exupéry's original manuscript for The Little Prince is preserved, she says making a film of such a beloved story is a real risk. And the first person to take on such a risk was none other than Orson Welles. Now, he had already made Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons and wanted to make a live-action film of The Little Prince with animation as well. So, of course, he approached Walt Disney. But this partnership never came to fruition, and it would be decades before anyone else would try again.
After the Orson Welles attempt, the next time The Little Prince would be adapted for American audiences began in the 1960s. And it happened thanks to a lawyer named Joseph Tandit. Tandit had no real connection to the industry, but a couple of friends had told him they wanted to make a movie out of The Little Prince and had an agreement from Gene Kelly to star as the aviator. And they needed him to, one, go to France and secure the rights from the St. Exupéry family, and then, two, go to California and get Gene Kelly to sign a contract. And even though he had no experience in this area, he flew to France and got the agreement with the St. Exupéry family. Then he flew to California to meet with Gene Kelly. And the great dancer, actor, choreographer, and director Gene Kelly had no idea what he was talking about. He was interested, though, but only in directing it. He had retired from acting. When Tandit went back to New York to tell his friends that he did have an agreement for the rights that would cost $10,000, but no Gene Kelly as the star, they lost interest. They didn't want to make it anymore. And that's when Tandit decided to do it himself. Tandit put his own $10,000 to secure the rights and was off to try to make a movie happen. He put out a press release announcing that he now had the movie rights to The Little Prince, and suddenly his phone was ringing off the hook. People were lining up looking to help him make The Little Prince. But Tandit had one man in mind for the job, an acclaimed lyricist who, as it turned out, already had a three-picture deal in place with Paramount. With two pictures already lined up, Paint Your Wagon and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, there was a spot already open for The Little Prince. And that lyricist was a man named Alan J. Lerner.
In the world of musical theater, the writing team of Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe are probably second only to Rodgers and Hammerstein when it comes to fame and notable Broadway hits. But it certainly didn't start out that way. They first met in 1942. Lerner, a New York native, was only 24 years old at the time, and Lowe, an Austrian immigrant, was 41 years old. Their first two collaborations were basically commercial flops, one of them not even making it to Broadway. It wasn't until 1947 with the musical Brigadoon that Lerner and Lowe became household names. After that came other Broadway successes with My Fair Lady and Camelot and the movie musical Gigi. As the lyricist and book writer, Alan J. Lerner also worked on adapting these musicals into films. But in 1960, after the opening of Camelot, Frederick Lowe, or Fritz, as he was known to his close friends, stated that it would be his last show before retirement. And with that, the two parted ways. Lerner would go on to collaborate with other writers, and while he found moderate success, he never reached the heights of his partnership with Frederick Lowe. In fact, fast forward to 1971, and Lerner was working with composer John Barry, the same one you heard about earlier. Now, Lerner and Barry were working on a musical adaptation of the notoriously controversial novel, Lolita. The production was scheduled for a multi-city tryout tour before eventually heading to Broadway. However, neither critics nor audiences reacted favorably to the production, and it ultimately never made it past Boston. Around that same time, though, Lerner reached back out to Frederick Lowe and sent him a motion picture script he had written of The Little Prince. The two spoke on the phone and rekindled their excitement of writing and working together again. Lerner said in his memoir, The Street Where I Live, that 11 years slipped away in a minute, and it was pre-Camelot again. Eventually, Stanley Donen was brought in to direct. He had a knack for turning musicals into movies with a string of hits, including Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, and his biggest hit of all, Singing in the Rain. Now, adapting a children's book into a movie isn't really that unique or unheard of, but what makes The Little Prince different is that the bulk of the plot and the weight of its themes and messages fall upon one young boy. So casting that title role had to be very specific and would take a very special kind of child actor to do it, pretty much finding a needle in a haystack. At the age of 5, Stephen Warner was sat down in front of a TV one night and was watching a variety show with a bunch of dancers. He was absolutely mesmerized by the dancing and pointed at the TV and said to his mother, "I want to do that." Now, his mother was once a dancer herself and was reluctant to have her child go into the same profession, but he persisted and was eventually enrolled in a stage school.
They sent me there for one term, and I absolutely hated it. Getting up really early in the morning, not getting home until late, having too much homework, and I didn't have a chance to play with my friends, you know, and I just thought, this is awful. I don't like this at all. So I told my mum, that's it. I don't want to be a dancer anymore. I hate it. You know, that's it. It's all over. And so my mum and dad agreed that I would come out of that school and just go back to a normal school. And I think it was the next day that I actually got the role in Little Prince.
Because you see, while he was at that school, even for just one term, talent scouts from Paramount Pictures had come to audition all the boys in the school.
They put all of the boys on the stage, and I was right on the end because I was the smallest. Right on the end, on stage left. I think I was more interested in the mechanism that made the curtains open and close, you know, And they did the thing that I hate about auditions, when they walk along the line going, no, 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 step forward. No, 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 step forward. And they got to me and I was not paying any attention. And they said, you know, step forward. And I said, why? And they said, we want you to sing for us. And I said, I can't sing. And they went, yeah, you can sing. Come on, sing us a song. And I went, no, I don't know any songs. And they said, okay, what about a nursery rhyme? Do you know any nursery rhymes? And I said, no. And I was doing what a normal, naughty kid would do. So I don't want to do it. I don't want to play. I'm not doing this. And eventually, they did actually manage to get me to sing one verse of When Santa Got Stuck Up the Chimney, because it was the only thing I could think of. And I guess that must have been good enough to get me a screen test. So I had 2 screen tests, I believe. And I think it was on the second one, I went up to this man and I said to him, can you tell me now, have I got the part? Because I don't want you to keep taking me out of school every time, you know, because you keep bringing me to these things and then telling me I've got to come back again. And I'm missing my classes and my friends at school, something like that. And apparently that was Joseph Tandy, the producer. And he thought that somebody of my age, if I had the guts to speak to him like that, I didn't know who he was though, but if I was going to be like that, it shouldn't really faze me being on a set in front of 40-50 people. And it kind of didn't really, you know, because I suppose when you're younger, you don't really have any fear, you know, because you think you're invincible. But yeah, I kind of got the part and I wasn't really trying to get it.
Now, the thing was, Stephen didn't really know what the audition was for. He didn't know the story of the Little Prince, and his mother really tried to play down the fact that this was for a big-budget film.
I didn't really know anything, except for when the phone call came through. I remember it being in an evening, and my mum screaming. And I was watching TV, and I'd just finished having some food. And she came in, she like hugged me, she goes, you've got the part. And I was like, oh, great. What is it? Shoe commercial? What is it? You know, am I eating cakes again or something? And she was like, no, it's in a film. And I was like, oh, okay. And I just thought it was a small part in a film. I had absolutely no idea that it was the title role. I didn't know.
So while Stephen was a newcomer to film, even though he had done a smattering of commercials here and there, the rest of the cast was a mix of British and American actors, a veritable list of who's who when it comes to stage and screen. Richard Kiley was cast as the aviator. Bob Fosse played the snake. Gene Wilder played the fox. Donna McKechnie played the part of the rose. And Joss Ackland was the king.
All of them, I didn't know who any of them were before I met them. I wasn't going to be told, oh, Steve, you're working, you know. Literally, the first time I met him, we did a little read-through, and they said, oh, this is Richard. And I was like, oh, hello, Richard. you know, I said, oh, I'm Stephen. He said, yes, I know you're Stephen. He said, I'm really pleased to meet you. He said, we're going to be doing this together. I said, so I'm going to help you. And you're going to help me. I said, okay.
But as the title character, Stephen was definitely the star of the show.
And everybody made me feel very special. But my mum was always there in the background. No, he's just a kid. He's just a kid. I think my mum was pretty keen to play it down because she was very much, you know, you're just a normal kid like all the other kids, you know. She never entertained anything like, you know, oh my God, you're a big star. She would never have anything like that. You know, if I wanted to go and ride a bike, you know, fall off and scrape my leg, fine. It didn't matter if you were filming the next day. She was like, no, he's a normal child.
And as a normal young boy, Stephen was rambunctious and excited. But as the long days of filming wore on, sometimes he wasn't as excited at being the little prince.
I guess the people at Paramount had worked with children before, and there's a wonderful tool called bribery. You know, that if the kids go, well, I'm tired, I'm bored of doing this now, I don't want to do that anymore. They would be like, hey, Stephen, have you seen this train set? You can have this if we just do that take one more time and we're going to get it just right. And there was a little bit of that going on, almost to the point of like where I'd actually seen the toy box, where I knew what was in it. There was a little bit of that going on. They knew what toys I liked. And so I got a lot of toys.
As far as the actual filming of Little Prince, how long did it last?
It kind of took a whole year. The part where we filmed in Tunisia, that was supposed to be 6 weeks, but I'm pretty sure they extended it and we stayed longer than 6 weeks. Then we had a little bit of a break, maybe a month, and then we were in the studios at Elstree. For me, what seemed like forever. You know, when you're that young, you know, a year seems like a decade, you know, and it seemed to go on and on and on and on. And then we kind of got to the bit when they said, okay, that's it. We've finished filming. And I was like, all right, when are we going to see it? When are we going to see it? And they went, oh, not for a long time yet. We've got to do all the dubbing next. And I went, what's that? I had no idea what it was. I'd never done anything like that before. I'd never seen anything like that before. The parts of music, the incidental music, I understand that it was possibly written after the film was put together. But I remember being in there with an orchestra for one bit, and they were playing music because there was one or two songs that didn't make it into the film. We filmed it and they were cut, but I remember one that Richard Kiley had, and it was a really nice song. And I was like, what? I can't believe they cut that song out. But they cut loads out anyway. But when we were on set, then obviously they had the playback going in the background. And I remember Mr. Donan saying to me, come on, Stephen, sing. And I went, I've already done it. It's on that track. And he said, no, we need you to sing it again. And I went, but I've already done it. And he said, no, I want to see your mouth moving. He said, the best way to do it is just sing it again. And I was thinking, God, they're really working me hard. There is one shot. They cut the sound out of it because it would have been his voice in it. He stood behind the camera with a glove puppet. It's the first time the camera sees me close up, and the camera's up high and it comes down low towards my face. And they've got all of the guys had all the reflector boards to reflect the sun back onto me. So all I was just blinded by this white light. And you can see me trying not to squint. So I was like that, you know, because they kept saying, Stephen, open your eyes. You need to look up. You need to open your eyes. And I was like, I said, but it's so bright, you know. And they said, yeah, but this is a really important, this is when we get to see you close up for the first time. I said, so it's really important that you don't screw your eyes up. And the puppets that I'm talking about, they're called Sooty and Sweep. They're English puppets. And Mr. Donan behind the camera, Stephen, Sooty says, open your eyes and look up here. And I was like that, you know. He says, look here, look here, look here. Sooty says this. Sooty. And I thought, oh my God, you know, like now I think about it, thinking only a handful of years before that, he was with Gene Kelly doing Singing in the Rain, for God's sake, you know. I mean, it's nuts when I think about it. He's one of the biggest musical directors in Hollywood. And he was just this nice man, you know. Well, he was nice to me.
Now, Stephen wasn't the only boy on set. There in Tunisia, there was a body double that would do some of the longer shots, especially when Stephen had to do schoolwork. Then in the studio, there was a stunt double hired to do some of the flying on wires. However, as soon as he was put up in the air, he started screaming and was immediately brought down again.
So I was like, I said, I'll do it. And they were like, oh, I don't know about this. I went, yeah. And my mom's like, no, let him do it. And they put the wires on me, took me up, and I was like, I love it, I can fly. And so I did all my own stunts in The Little Prince.
And one of the most unique sets in the film was The Little Prince's Planet B612.
The whole planet did used to rotate around. So it obviously was fixed to the wall behind it, was just the half of it. Sometimes there was people inside it as well. Like everything that was on the outside of it was bolted to it, except me. I was on wires. And obviously they just rotated the camera at the same time as the planet. So it looked like I was walking upside down. But that it was really high up in the air. So anything where I sort of like jumped off of it and like flew away, which there was a couple of shots that they kept in that was like that. The whole sequence with the lamplighter was taking out the film, which is a bit of a shame. But he was an animatronic thing. He wasn't even a person. And the planet for that was actually really small. And the only thing that was on it was the guy and the lamp. And I think maybe they took it out because it wasn't very realistic. And there was another one where they had just a part of the planet, but that was actually quite low near the floor. And those things were boring because I wasn't on wires. I was like, on wires, so much more fun. I nearly broke my leg actually on one shot. They wanted me to fly towards the camera and just go over it. And the guy that was supposed to pull the cable to make me go up, I think he wasn't paying attention and I flew into the camera. And apparently I broke something on the camera, but I screamed the studio down and I think they had to stop filming that day and send me off for an x-ray because they were worried that I'd broken my knee. But no, it's okay. Another train set that shut me up.
One of the most iconic parts of The Little Prince is the cloak that he wears and the sword that he has off to the side. But for Stephen, this wasn't one of his favorite parts.
There was actually four coats. There was one for flying because it had holes all over it so they could attach the wires. There was another one that didn't have buttons and the sword. I can't remember why. There was one that was made specifically for me. And now I think there was like a standby one or something. But I remember wearing it for the first time. And when they put it on me, I went, oh, but, and I was like, I said, this is really heavy. And they were like, well, you know, it has to be made of this fabric. It was made up in London, some costumers there. And it was incredibly heavy. And I actually still have it. I'm not supposed to have it. I mean, the reason I got it was because for part of the promotion for the movie, I had to go to the States. And it was kind of cool because we flew out on Pan Am from London to JFK. And they wanted me to arrive as the Little Prince. So I remember the flight attendant telling my mum, okay, it's 2 hours to landing now. So she had to take me to the toilet and get me all changed into the stuff. And I remember walking down the aisle to go back to my seat and everyone on the plane going, oh my God, it's the little prince. Because when I didn't have everything on, I didn't look anything like it. And so I sort of sat there. And when we got to JFK, the thing that I remember was the first thing that happened was that they took photographs for Pan Am because it was in their advertisements or something. You know, although the little prince can fly, he flies at Pan Am or something like that. I can't remember exactly. So they wanted lots of photographs with me on their plane. And then they threw a blanket over me and rushed me through the airport and threw me into the back of a limousine. And my mom was like, well, what's that all about then? So we had, well, I still got the whole outfit, everything, with the exception of the sword. I don't know what happened to that. Maybe we didn't take it. But everything went with us to the States with a little promotional tour. And when we got back, I think my mum deliberately forgot to send it all back to Paris.
But as any actor will tell you when doing a show, some of the most long-lasting memories come from the connections and friendships that are made on set or on stage. And as the two main characters, Stephen Warner and Richard Kiley, spent a lot of time together.
And I remember Richard as being one of the nicest people ever. He was so, so kind to me. Lovely and friendly. And like, even between takes, everything, like, normally people say, if you need me, I'll be in my trailer. It wasn't like that at all. He'd be like, okay, come on, Stephen, let's go and play. Let's go and do this. Let's go and do that. Because I couldn't play with Tommy, the guy, the other kid on the set, because he would be working then, like setting up for the next shot or doing something else. So I didn't really get to play with him until in the evenings. You know, and then it was a case of like, okay, you need to eat some food. You've got 1 hour of like learning script and then it's bed. So our playtime was very, very brief. It's really strange because when people say about the Rings, they will say, oh, the leading guy was Gene Wilder. I would say, no, it was actually Richard Kiley. And a lot of people in the UK, they go, who? And I say, you do know his voice. And I said, maybe you don't know his name, but I said, if you've ever seen the film Jurassic Park, you know his voice. I said, they even say, we got the best, we got Richard Kiley. That is a line in Jurassic Park. And also in another film that I absolutely loved, it's The Producers. Not the original with Gene Wilder, but the remake that Mel Brooks did. And there's a little thing, and if you blink, you'll miss it, but it's towards the beginning, and they're outside a theatre, and it actually says on the side of the theatre, Richard Kiley.
So yes, at that time, as Stephen said, Gene Wilder was a bigger name than Richard Kiley. He was certainly a big star here in the U.S. Having already starred in The Producers and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, but Gene Wilder's appearance in The Little Prince almost didn't happen. In 1973, Gene Wilder was living in New York and working on the script for Young Frankenstein. During this time, he got a call from Stanley Donen to meet with him and Alan J. Lerner about their adaptation of The Little Prince. Now, Donen told Wilder he could play any part he wanted, but thought the fox was the best part, and after reading the script, Wilder agreed and said he would be happy to do it. At the same time, Mel Brooks was working on his latest film, Blazing Saddles. Now, casting had been problematic throughout filming, and it finally came to a head one day while they were working on the first scene of The Waco Kid. And Gene Wilder writes in his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger, about a particular phone call with Mel Brooks.
After I finished writing the first draft of Young Frankenstein, and just as I was about to leave for a little vacation with my wife Jo, before going to London to start The Little Prince, Mel called from a soundstage at Warner Brothers Studio. I need you right now. Dan Daly begged off doing the Waco Kid because he was too tired. So I got Gig Young. But Gig started foaming at the mouth on the way to the first scene in the jail cell. I thought he was just doing some preparation for the part. I said, keep doing what you're doing. I didn't know he'd just gotten on the wagon. We had to send for an ambulance to carry him out. I yelled, it's a sign from God. I'm calling you from a payphone next to the set. Can you come right away? But Mel, I have to be in London in 2 weeks to do The Little Prince for Stanley Donen. Call him up. Ask if you can come later. I called Stanley in London and told him the situation. He said, do you really want to do Mel's film? I said, I really want to help Mel if I can. All right, I'll shoot your scenes at the end of the schedule instead of the beginning. I left for Los Angeles the next day.
And of course, Blazing Saddles went on to become an iconic performance in Wilder's long career. And it was also where he met Madeline Kahn for the first time and suggested to Brooks that she would be wonderful in Young Frankenstein. And so we have Stanley Donen to thank for all of it by just agreeing to rearrange his shooting schedule.
I'm glad that they let him go, you know, to do that, because I don't think anybody else would be able to do it the same.
But that rearrangement also allowed Wilder to take another, more personal trip.
Before I left for London to do The Little Prince, I went to Milwaukee to visit my father, who was seriously ill. I tried to make him laugh, telling him about Mel Brooks and Blazing Saddles and Dom DeLuise singing, "Stick out your tush!" But when I kissed him goodbye, I knew I was seeing him for the last time. A week later, I was told that my father had died. I was filming in an enormous artificial wheat field on a huge soundstage, delivering the most memorable lines in the script. It's only with the heart that one can see clearly. What's essential is invisible to the eye.
That scene in the wheat field was actually done in a sound studio, but the main scene between Wilder and the Little Prince was done on location in the UK and involved about 3 weeks of shooting to do scene work and the song Closer and Closer. But to a six-year-old boy, it wasn't filming a musical sequence in the woods that stuck out to him.
And I kept saying to my mum, "Are you sure he's Gene? That's a girl's name." And she's like, "No, no, it's spelled different." I was like, "Okay." And I didn't know any men called Gene, you know, but I knew a few women called Gene. I was like, okay. And we chatted and everything, and same sort of thing. We went through some script together, and I absolutely loved that sequence with the Fox. And he was just the nicest person, the nicest person. And he used to call me on my birthday for a good 10 years afterwards, just to wish me happy birthday. Such a lovely man.
And so every other week or so, new actors were joining the filming process, usually just for one scene.
It was sort of like, you know, every week, well, who is it this week? You know, where are we this week?
Sometimes Stephen had a lot to do, like with Gene Wilder as the Fox, but most of the time, the adult actor was the star of that particular scene. That was the case when Joss Ackland joined the set.
And that was only for 1 week, 5 days. It was very, very brief. I just remember like going over and over and over like a few specific lines because there was hardly any dialogue. It was mostly him singing and chasing me around that planet, which is the same one as some of the others. But don't tell anyone. They just painted it differently. But it was... I didn't really have that much to do with him, really. So I didn't get to know him quite as well as the others. It was just very brief because even though, like, you know, you might have thought it's me on set, it wasn't always me. It might have been Tommy. So I really didn't have that much to do with him. But the thing I do remember about Joss Ackland, he had a really long cape, and all the little houses that you can see on the planet, they were like made of balsa wood. And his cape used to knot them all over the place. And they kept trying to stick them all together with sticky tape. And I think they were just losing a battle because his cape was so heavy. You know, he used to like, if it hit anything, stuff would go flying. I think in the end, they just said, just leave it. Just let all the pieces fly everywhere.
Now, Stanley Donen had started out as a dancer and choreographer. But by this point in his career, he was focused on directing. So when it came time to stage the scene for the snake, played by Bob Fosse, he of course allowed Fosse full creative freedom to stage and choreograph his musical number called A Snake in the Grass.
And again, everybody on set, "Hey Bob, I just thought this, the nice man that could dance." I had no idea who he was. So because for me, it was normal. There wasn't anything like, "Oh my God," you know. And he didn't act like the big star. None of them did. They were just all normal people. And during the whole process of filming, I was absolutely mesmerized by watching him dance. Because if you remember, like, dancing was the thing that actually got me interested in that industry in the first place. So every time, you know, the music was playing and the cameras were off, I was just absolutely transfixed watching him dance. When the film was actually finished, I was invited up to a place up in London, and I can't remember again who it was that invited us, and they said, "You can see two scenes from the film, Steve. We don't want to spoil it for you, but we'll let you see two scenes." And my mum was there like thinking, "Oh God, please, you know, choose like a really good one." And I said, "Oh, I want to see Bob Fosse dance. Can I see the part with the snake?" And my mum was like, "Stephen, you're not really in that much. You don't say that much." And I said, "No, I want to see him dance." I said, "Because it's amazing." I just was absolutely fascinated by his dancing. It wasn't until a little bit later that the penny actually dropped who that man was, you know, and like what he was responsible for. And like even shows that I go to see now, I just look at them and like when people still talk about, you know, jazz hands, and I was like, that's Bob.
But Bob Fosse wasn't the only big-time Broadway dancer to join the filming. In the early 1970s, Donna McKechnie was a well-established theater actress and dancer, having already been in 5 Broadway shows by that point. And so in 1972, she performed in a London production of Stephen Sondheim's Company, which Stanley Donen had seen her in and later invited her to play the part of the Rose. In her musical theater memoir, Time Steps, McKechnie wrote how she was also able to bring a fellow dancer into the film as well.
Stanley was staging the movie, but he needed a choreographer. With Michael Bennett not available, I prevailed upon him to hire Ron Farella, a teacher with whom I had been studying with in New York. Intense and sometimes temperamental, Ron had never choreographed either a Broadway show or a movie. In spite of his rough edges, I thought he had real potential, and I wanted to help him. I also figured that we could work well together since we had similar styles and training. After holding out ungracefully for more money, he finally joined us in London.
But almost from the start, McKechnie wasn't comfortable with the filming or the direction. The scene and song between the Little Prince and the Rose was one where McKechnie's image was going to be superimposed over a visual of the Rose. So she was shot against a black velvet backdrop on a set surrounded by a multitude of technicians, an experience that was vastly different from what she was used to, performing in front of a live theater audience.
I'd heard the song before, and they explained it to me that we're never actually going to be in the same scene, but she's going to be like a little person inside the flower. And I was like, okay. And they said they'll do it with projections. And I said, okay. And they said that there was plans for her to walk up my arm and sing. And obviously that never quite happened. So I don't think they had quite had the technology to do that then. But I know the little bits that they filmed with her was actually on the next soundstage at Elstree when we were filming something. So I know that she was there. And I did meet her very briefly once.
So since the Rose and the Little Prince weren't going to be on camera at the same time, it had to be staged a little differently, which was fine. But then there was Stanley Donen's direction of what he wanted the Rose to dance like. He wanted McKechnie's number to be a seductive dance with bumps and grinds. But since the scene was with the Little Prince, a 7-year-old Stephen Warner, McKechnie was reluctant to go that way with it.
I tried to compromise with a more playful approach, which was sexy but not too hard-edged, as if I were a child in a woman's body. My efforts really didn't matter in the end. I found myself frustrated by the whole process of making this film. I wasn't helped along the way when the director and choreographer had creative differences. Stanley would stomp his feet in frustration, and eventually he barred Ron from the lot. The atmosphere on set was tense and uncomfortable. When I saw the movie months later, I was mortified. My scene had been cut to ribbons and the music was changed completely. The song I sang, Be Happy, was in my soprano voice, but my voice in the scene was dubbed by someone with a very low, sultry English accent. It occurred to me that Stanley never had any intention to use my speaking voice.
But Donna McKechnie wasn't the only one unhappy with her number. In March of 1974, Alan Lerner wrote a letter to his agent, bringing him up to date on the Little Prince production. He called the sequence when the Rose sings Be Happy an absolute abomination. He went on to say that the president of Paramount Pictures, Frank Yablans, was revolted by it, as was producer Joseph Tandit, Frederick Lowe, and himself. Despite all of this, Donen refused to change the number, with one of his arguments being that famed director Peter Bogdanovich thought it was terrific. Unfortunately, the disagreements and bitterness only grew when the movie was finally released in November of 1974. In his own memoir, The Street Where I Live, Alan Lerner didn't mince words with how he felt about the end result.
It was never heard on the screen as Fritz had composed it. The director, someone called Stanley Donen, took it upon himself to change every tempo, delete musical phrases at will, and distort the intention of every song, until the score was entirely unrecognizable. Unlike the theater where the author is the final authority, in motion pictures, it is the director. And if one falls in the hands of some cinematic Bigfoot, one pays the price for someone else's ineptitude. In this case, the price was high, because it was undoubtedly Fritz's last score.
The first time I actually saw it was in London, and I went along with my mom, my sister, a couple of friends, a couple of my mom's friends. There was like a group of us. We went up, and they had closed the top balcony. It was just for us. And I remember thinking that I was in some ways a little bit disappointed because they'd cut out lots of bits that I really liked. And I was like, what happened to that bit with Gene? And what happened to that bit? You know, why is that not in there? Because if I've understood it correctly, the original cut, they said it was way too long. So they cut a lot of stuff out of the film to make it more bearable for the audience, you know, so it was only 90 minutes. But yeah, there was some bits that I was disappointed at because I thought that there was other nice bits that they could have left in. But I suppose that the essential part of it is the actual story. It's not the bits that I liked. It's not the bits that my mum liked. You know, it had to still tell the story.
Critical reception of The Little Prince was decidedly mixed. Vincent Canby of the New York Times called the film exasperating, saying it was too abstract for children, yet too simple-minded for adults. He went on to say that the music of Lerner and Lowe was full of lovely things, but a total waste in these barren circumstances. However, local critics like Boris Nelson of the Toledo Blade said it was an intriguing fantasy, noting it was an aesthetically gratifying film and should be seen by children of all ages. But one of the most interesting reviews from 1974 came from The Village Voice and Alexandra Sheedy, a 12-year-old film critic. She acknowledges that grown-ups might find the film boring and that younger children probably wouldn't understand it, but says there's middle-aged children that will get it and says the movie is funnier and clearer than the book and that she really enjoyed it. She went on to say that the film isn't so bad and didn't really deserve all of the negative response and reviews it had been getting. After all, she says, grown-ups really shouldn't see and expect to like the same things kids do.
I mean, I still get fan mail, sorry, which I just think, really? You know, it's an old film. It's a long time ago, but they nearly always say the same thing. And it's always like, I don't think you understand what that film meant to me. When I was going through this part of my life or when this happened, I found it very comforting. So I make my children watch it. There's an awful lot of people that have taken the time to seek me out and to thank me. And I just think, I don't really understand why. But to me, it was just, that was an adventure that I had. I didn't really think it would have a profound effect on anybody else, but I guess it must have.
For all its negative press, though, The Little Prince did receive 2 Oscar nominations for music and actually won the Golden Globe for Best Original Score. However, the ultimate downfall of this 1974 movie musical was that no one went to see it. Its box office gross didn't even reach $1 million. Now, by comparison, Blazing Saddles was the top film of that year with almost $120 million, and Young Frankenstein came in at number 4 on the list, bringing in just over $86 million. For Stephen Warner, though, this on-screen debut paved the way for a few other appearances in film and television, but as he grew, his artistic and creative interests were drawn elsewhere. And in the next episode, you'll hear more from Stephen as he finds joy in a completely different art form altogether, all while dealing with the loss of his mother. Now, WinMe subscribers on Supercast will get the full audio and video of my interview with Stephen Warner about The Little Prince. You'll see and hear even more details about this Lerner and Lowe movie musical production. Now, if you're not already a subscriber, you can become one today by going to join.winmepodcast.com or just look for the link in the show notes. Now, there were two other voices you heard in this episode that might have sounded a little familiar to you. Reading from Donna McKechnie's memoir was another triple threat performer, Gabrielle Ruiz, who's been on this podcast before in season 5. And reading from the memoir by Gene Wilder was another funny actor, Peter Allen Vogt, who also appeared in season 5. Thank you so much for joining myself and Dan as we explored this movie musical of The Little Prince with special guest Stephen Warner. You can learn more about other adaptations in parts 1 and 2 of our series called Two Princes. Just go to industrypodcast.org. And remember, stay tuned for my follow-up interview with Stephen Warner all about his life and career beyond The Little Prince. And just a little sneak preview, after that episode, we'll come an interview with another actor who portrayed The Little Prince, Anthony Rapp. He'll share stories and experiences he doesn't often share about his time on Broadway and his other work in film and television. Well, as always, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, and this podcast is a production of WinMe Media. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.